with me is Susan Seidelman, who produced and directed the film Smithereens, which opens tomorrow night at the TLA on 3rd and South Streets. Smithereens is about a woman named Ren who wants to become a new wave star, but she's neither a singer nor a musician. She works at a photocopying store where she runs off copies of self-promotional handbills with a punkish-looking picture of herself with the caption, "Who is this woman?" She pastes these on subways and buildings around Manhattan. She captures the attention of Paul, who's a nice but naive teenager from Montana, who has just escaped to the big city where he's broke and feels like an outsider. He lives in his van parked on a lot off the West Side Highway. Ren seems worldly and hip to him, and he likes her enough to tolerate her incredible selfishness. She spends much of her time pursuing a new wave musician who is played by Richard Hell. I think this is Hell's first acting role. He's a new wave musician who recorded with his group Richard Hell and the Voidoids. We'll probably have some time to listen to one of his records a little later. Smithereens gets its title from Ren's comment that sometimes she thinks that the world blew up 5 years ago, that everybody is now floating around on little pieces of it, not realizing what's happened. The movie is shot in vacant lots, subways, East Village apartments, Manhattan streets, and the New Wave Club, the Peppermint Lounge. Susan Seidelman is a native Philadelphian. She grew up in Abington. She's had Smithereens has had a very successful run in the New York Greenwich Village Theater, the Waverly, and last year it was entered in the Cannes Film Festival, where it was the first independent film ever entered in the main competition. It will play beginning tomorrow night at the TLA on 3rd and South Street. It will run through May 12th, and then from there it will move for the following week at the Roxy Theater at 2021 Sansom Street, and Smithereens will play at the Roxy from May 13th through 19th. Susan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, nice to be here.
Do you want to say any more about the story before we talk about the film?
Not really about the plot. It's interesting because for me the story is much more, it's really a character study or a slice of life kind of film, and the plot is really just a vehicle to be able to show these characters.
How was the story developed? Did you know people like this?
Yeah, people often ask me if it's autobiographical. It really isn't, although there are probably elements of the character, you know, that I can certainly relate to. But I used to live near the East Village, and I moved there in the middle 70s, like 1974, I think. And at that time, in the early, in the late 60s and early 70s, the neighborhood was kind of a countercultural mecca of sorts, you know, with the hippie movement and stuff. And then when I was there in the mid 70s, the neighborhood was abandoned a bit. You know, the hippies had moved out, nothing was really happening. And then around 1976, 77, a new group of people started moving in, and a lot of that centered around the new wave rock and roll music scene. And I found these people that were moving in pretty interesting. And suddenly there was a lot of energy. Things were happening in that neighborhood. And that's why I decided that I wanted to make a film about that particular milieu. And I also, the character of Ren intrigued me. I've known Wrens in my life, male and female Ren characters, but I never had really seen them in a film before. So for me, the film stemmed from the neighborhood and the character.
Did you feel inside or outside that new wave culture?
Mixed. You know, I mean, I know people who are part of it, and I used to frequent some of the rock and roll clubs, although I'm not an East Village native, you know.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the characters who you developed for listeners who haven't seen the film yet?
Well, to me, Ren, what I found interesting about her is that she really is sort of a victim of the pop culture of the 1970s and 1980s. She's someone who believes all the hype. You know, she believes the lyrics and the rock and roll songs are true. And she's somebody who doesn't really think she needs to have any particular skills to be famous. You know, she can, if she promotes herself and she has enough guts, she can be famous without having any being able to sing or play an instrument or anything else. It's kind of what she's kind of the epitome of the Andy Warhol saying that everyone could be famous for 15 minutes or something. And so she seemed, because the theme of the idea of the influence of pop culture really appealed to me, and also the idea of the fragmentedness of contemporary life and the idea that people are sort of coming and going and moving in different places and feeling disconnected, that character, to me, epitomized both those things.
She really desperately wants in, mm-hmm. into you know, the new wave world. Were you ever in that position of desperately wanting into something, maybe film?
Well, I think she's an outsider. I mean, she's a girl from New Jersey who probably has gotten a lot of her information about the world from records and from TV and from billboard imagery and stuff. And so she believes, you know, there's all these amazing things happening out there, and here I am in New Jersey being outside of it. And I think for me, there was a bit of that, you know, growing up in Philadelphia and Abington, feeling like all this exciting stuff was happening in New York, for example, and my life seemed rather boring in comparison.
She's from a very working-class kind of family, mm-hmm. who has hardly any money, I think, from the little that you see, mm-hmm. of them. Abington is much more middle-class community. Yeah. What did you choose the kind of New Jersey working-class environment for her?
Just because, I don't know, I just found that interesting. But, I mean, I think the same thing is applicable. I know upper middle-class people who are like that too. To me, it's the idea of feeling like you're not where the action is. And I think that also that theme, it really didn't even have to be placed in a New Wave setting. I think that theme is applicable for various other kinds of settings too.
She kind of gets close to being a bag person, mm-hmm. as the film progresses. I've always wondered how people who look my age end up on the streets. Was that something you were curious about too?
Well, to some extent, I really don't see her. Hopefully she won't be a bag lady. I'd like to believe that, because I think that also she does have a lot of ingenuity and energy. And hopefully, I mean, I think her problem is that she channels it in the wrong direction. And maybe at some point in her life, she'll decide to rechannel that energy. I think she's a survivor, though. I do. And for me, one of the things about her at the very end of the film, I think throughout the whole film, she's the kind of person who has these toss-off phrases. You know, I've got a million and one places to go is a phrase she keeps repeating. And I think at the end of the film, she realizes that she doesn't have a place to go, and hopefully that will shock her into redirecting her life a little bit.
Susan Seidelman is my guest, and she produced and directed the film Smithereens, which opens tomorrow night at the TLA. How did you scout for locations in New York? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the great thing about New York City is that if you just keep your eyes open, there's so many. I mean, visually, the city is so alive that it really isn't hard to find interesting locations. And I knew that I was looking for a certain there was a certain kind of trashy look I had in mind when I was making the film, and certainly the downtown area parts of New York, the East Village, and also along the highway, there are a lot of very interesting, trashy locations.
One of the locations that you have is a lot, mm-hmm. Off the West Side Highway, mm-hmm. in which people live out of their cars or their, mm-hmm. vans, as one of the characters in the film does.
Yeah.
Is it like that in Manhattan now, in that lot? Did you have people move in there for the movie, or were there, in fact, people already living in that lot?
No, there weren't people living in that particular lot, but a couple blocks away, actually, I had bumped into, we'd been driving around scouting locations, and I saw this abandoned pier that I thought was pretty interesting looking, and right nearby there was this mobile home where a rock musician and I guess his girlfriend and dog were living in a mobile home right on this abandoned pier, and I found that kind of interesting, and, you know, the outskirts of all these, the shadow of all these high-rise buildings, that somebody was living in a trailer appealed to me. And also for me, again, the idea of living on wheels, the idea of the unrootedness of that seemed to fit in with the theme of the film.
Did you ever consider asking people who are actually living like that to be extras in the film?
Mm-hmm. There were some extras who were, for example, there was one point where we were filming outside of the Peppermint Lounge, which is in the Times Square area, and there were some hookers that were getting a little annoyed with us because we were apparently ruining some of their business by setting up all our lights outside of the Peppermint Lounge. And at one point, we invited them to be in the film. Ultimately, their scene was cut out. But often we were using street people to just, you know, play themselves as minor characters.
Were they pleased to be invited?
Some were, sure. Yeah.
What did you want to communicate through the locations that, mm-hmm. that you saw?
Well, again, this idea of things falling apart. That was the word smithereens. That was the theme I was dealing with. And the idea of, you know, vacant vacant lots and crumbling facades and graffiti and all that seemed to lend itself visually to the idea of fragmentation. And also the thing that I liked about graffiti is, although there's a cartoon quality to graffiti that appealed to me and seemed to be in tune with the whole new wave aesthetic.
Did you have a graffiti artist come in and dress the sets?
There was a guy, his name is Lee Kionis, who I had heard about. I had actually seen some of the trains. He worked in subway cars in New York, and he used to go in with a can of spray paint and do up entire trains in really beautiful ways. And I had heard about him, and I had also seen some walls that he had painted down in near the projects in Lower Manhattan. And somebody knew how to get a hold of this guy, and I met him, and I just loved his work so much that I asked him to come and do some of the sets for us.
Which parts did he do?
He painted the van, and he painted some of the walls that characters stand against. But it's interesting because he was part of a graffiti gang called the Fabulous Five. And what's happening in New York right now is the whole graffiti art movement has sort of gone indoors. A lot of gallery owners are now having these graffiti artists paint canvases rather than trains. And there's kind of a controversy as to whether that's really going against the whole grain of what should be an outlaw art form. You know, the whole underground thing of having to sneak into subways and work that way. Maybe it's been co-opted a little bit by painting on canvas.
Yeah, do you have any stand on that issue?
I have kind of mixed feelings about it. I think that part of its charm was that it was for the people, and once you sort of bring it into a museum, suddenly it's no longer for the people. It's for a very select group who are museum goers.
I've been referring to Smithereens as a new wave movie in part because it's set in part in the Pepperland Lounge, and one of the main characters is a new wave performer, and of course Ren wants to get into that scene. But I think there's also it's more than that. It's more than what it's about. It's something about how it looks. Feels very new wave too. Can you talk about the things that you tried in the directing of it, or in the dress of the sets that you wanted to use to be compatible with what you wanted to get from the new wave aspect of it?
As I said, the whole idea of this kind of we live in a disposable culture, and the whole idea of consumer art or trash art really appealed to me. So in terms of the set, we were looking for a very pop look, pop graphics. And again, when I first thought of the idea, imagine the character of Ren. I was thinking in terms of a cartoon character, actually Olive Oil, and I knew I wanted to make a kind of gritty street cartoon. You know, in terms of the character's attitudes a little bit, and in terms of the look of the set, and also the influence of op art. I mean, there's a very strong graphic op quality to it, you know, checkers and stripes and stuff like that.
Yeah, that reminds me of the opening sequence in it, which I think is a wonderful sequence. Can I ask you to describe it?
Well, it starts off with a shot of a woman holding a pair of checkered sunglasses, but it's shot from waist down, so you just sort of see her bright purple dress and these checkered sunglasses, and then a set of feet wearing sneakers and a black and white checkered vinyl miniskirt enters the frame, and the skirt matches identically the pair of sunglasses, and suddenly a hand reaches out and swipes the sunglasses and dashes off down a subway tunnel. And it's also done in stop motion and in slow motion. And then the opening, the shots continue with a chase through a subway, and where she hooks up with this guy, Paul, who's a character from Montana, who's just arrived in New York. She kind of flirts with him in the subway a little bit, and just they don't say anything to each other, but she hands him a Xerox photocopy of her face and then walks off the train, and he's intrigued by that and starts following after her. And that's how the two main characters meet.
One of the things I love about that opening sequence is there's no dialogue in it. You have no idea what the movie's about or anything, but the two check patterns matching up, and then Ren running off with the sunglasses has such an energetic opening to it.
I knew that I wanted to set the mood instantly for what kind of film it would be by that opening image.
And what is it about the image that does that? The checks?
I think it is. I think it is. And I think it's also that there's a kind of mystery about what's going on and who the characters are, because you're just watching people from the waist down
Was it hard to get the cooperation of the Peppermint Lounge?
Well, when we were making Smithereens, and we had no money whatsoever, and so we were trying to barter as much as possible. And originally, I had approached the Peppermint Lounge and to go in and try to rent the place for the night would have cost me several thousand dollars, and I just didn't have that money. So I found out that on Tuesday nights was kind of an off night for them, and I told them that if I would bring a band, I proposed to bring a band and fill the place up with extras, and they would let me use the place for free if they could keep the bar opened. So that way I was able to use their place. They were able to make money off the bar. And so we just went around New York. We Xeroxed flyers saying, you know, come to the Peppermint Lounge, be in a film, hear this band. And we got a pretty large turnout. So it kind of met all of our needs.
That's really clever.
Yeah. A lot of the film was done like that. For example, there was one location, the apartment where Ren lives. I knew I wanted her apartment to have a kind of funky exterior, and we wanted to paint this building, her apartment building, a bright, really chartreuse green, and we couldn't find a building that had a bright enough facade. So we just walked around the neighborhood, and we knocked on different people's doors, and we found this one man who was the landlord of a building that was painted brown and all peeling paint, and he agreed to let us paint the entire front of his building bright green if after we were done filming, if we would paint it back black. So that way we were able to get our bright green building, and he was able to get a fresh coat of paint.
Who painted it?
The art director. but by making, you know, by series of trade-offs, we were able to get what we want and also help people, you know, get what they wanted.
Yeah, I guess, what did you use as evidence of your credibility when you wanted someone... Mm-hmm. to be sure that, for instance, at the Peppermint Lounge, that you'd not only make good on your deal, but that you'd take care of the place and be responsible?
Yeah, I don't know. People were very – I think people are basically like to help out, and I think they're also intrigued by film. The whole idea of making a film is appealing to a lot of people. I think that you know, I just my enthusiasm and enthusiasm of the other people that were working in the film were the selling point, because we didn't have money and we couldn't really guarantee anything, except I think that they picked up on our energy.
They must be real happy about it now.
I think so.
How did you find the different people in the cast? Let's start with Richard Hale. How did you hook up with him, and why did you cast him?
Well, let me start with somebody else, because he was actually the last person to come in the project. Initially, we had placed an ad in one of the trade papers called Backstage in New York, and it was a really horrendous ad. You know, it said, no pay, long hours, hard work. I mean, everything negative that you could think of. We were very upfront about in the ad, and we must have gotten about 1,000 responses, because there's apparently a lot of out of work actors in New York, you know. And we auditioned maybe 100 different people, and there were some very good people, but I couldn't find for the main character. I couldn't find somebody who had the right combination of professionalism and also street sense. So I was getting a little frustrated, and a friend of mine one day went to an off Broadway play and happened to see this woman sitting in the audience. She wasn't even in the play, she was just in the audience, and just was intrigued by the way she looked. And after the play, he walked up to her and said, we're holding auditions for this film, would you like to come? Gave her the address, and kind of as an afterthought said, oh, by the way, are you an actress? And she kind of shrugged and said she had been in a play before, but, you know, had never really done any film. Anyway, she showed up at the audition, and just something about the way she looked and especially the way she walked appealed to me. And for me, it was just kind of a gut feeling. I just knew I wanted to work with this woman.
What was it about how she walked?
She had this very wiry kind of this feeling like if you pushed her down, she'd pop back up. I can't explain it, but
Does it get back to the olive oil image?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, she also physically, she's very thin, she had very long legs, and she was wearing big boots, like combat boots. And there was just something appealing about the fragileness. She was very skinny. There was a kind of fragileness, but also a toughness about her that appealed to me.
So who is the next person to be cast?
The next person was Brad Rinn, the guy who plays Paul, the kid from Montana. Again, we were trying to find somebody who seemed like they were from out of town. And we auditioned a lot of male actors who were originally from the Midwest, but somehow once they were in New York, they put on sophisticated airs and they were trying to lose all the country bumpkinness. And finally, I was getting a little frustrated, and the same friend of mine happened to be walking through, I think it was Washington Square Park, and saw this kid sitting on a park bench reading an acting book, and walked over to him and asked him if he'd like to come to an audition. And as it turned out, he was from the Midwest and had just arrived in New York about a month before. And when he came in for the audition, I just saw him, and he was the character of Paul. And I knew I wanted him. And the Richard Hell character, originally, we had had another actor playing the rock star character. He was a European guy, a French actor. And the character was very different initially, much more kind of chic in a way. And we had started shooting the film, and we had shot for 2 weeks, and we were about to begin the section where the rock star and Ren were to begin their relationship. And we had a day off to rehearse that scene. And during that rehearsal, Susan Berman, the lead actress, fell off a fire escape and dropped about 16 feet, and she broke her leg. And obviously the shooting came to an abrupt halt. And during that four-month period, the actor who was initially cast in the role had to go off to Europe because he had a commitment to play the Elephant Man in the Paris production of The Elephant Man. And so I was stuck without a lead. And also what happened was during that four-month period, I had a chance to kind of reevaluate the character and think about the direction I wanted to move the character in. And I decided that maybe it would be better to cast it with an American and use a real rock star. And one day we were sitting around with a group of friends and tossing out ideas about who the character of Ren might be attracted to. And, you know, we came up with, you know, Mick Jagger and David Bowie and realized we could never get those people. And somebody said, well, what about someone like Richard Hell? And somebody else said, well, why not just ask Richard Hell if he'd be interested? So that's how I contacted Richard, and he read the script and liked it.
So he was just willing to do it?
Yeah.
My guest is Susan Seidelman, who produced and directed the film Smithereens, which opens tomorrow night at the TLA. Why don't we just take a short break here and listen to one of Richard Hell's records?
Great.
For our listeners who might not have heard anything by Richard Hell and the Voidoids, this is probably one of his more famous tunes. It's called Blank Generation.
Blank generation, and I can take it or leave it each time. Well, I belong to the generation, but I can take it or leave it each time.
Richard Hell, and that was his own song, Blank Generation. And my guest is Susan Seidelman, the director and producer of Smithereens. And Richard Hell is one of the stars of that film. Was this the first time he'd ever acted in a film?
He had been in one other film previous to Smithereens, and that was a film called Blank Generation that was directed by a man named Uli Lommel, who was one of Fassbender's protégés. And the film, it was never released in the United States. Apparently, it was kind of documentary style, but I think the experience for Richard wasn't very positive in that film because it kind of, he said they would come in and they would never even know what they were filming the day that they were supposed to be filming. But I think although he didn't like himself, he didn't like the film, he did like acting, and it did kind of excite him about the idea of acting on a film, in a film, you know.
What kind of direction did you give him?
We rehearsed. We did a lot of improvisations. I mean, the script, the film was pretty heavily scripted, but what I would do is I would often give the script to the actors and I'd let them read through it a few times and I'd pull the script away and let them improvise off of it, because often they would be able to add their own twist to the dialogue, and that often made the characters much more lively or believable.
How would you compare Richard Hell with the performer who you had him play?
I think he's different than the character that he plays, but I think he's had enough experiences in that world that he could add a lot of himself to the part. But he isn't Eric, the character he plays.
How did he get along with the woman who plays Ren off camera?
I think they got along pretty well. In fact, I think that they were both intrigued by each other, and I think some of the chemistry between them personally only helped in the film.
Were you afraid that the movie would never come together when you had to take off 4 months while Susan recovered from her broken leg?
Oh, yeah, because it was very hard. I wasn't paying anyone. We were all sort of doing it because we believed in the project, and we didn't know what would happen. So trying to keep a group of 20 people together that you're not paying over a year period, because actually the shooting was stretched out over a one-year period. At times I had serious doubts whether I'd be able to pull this thing off. But I think that ultimately all the problems sort of brought us all closer together. I think we began to feel like we were a family at some point, and I think that's what helped.
The film was made for $80,000?
Right.
That's really like nothing.
That's sort of coffee money for a Hollywood film.
Right. Were you afraid that once you started a major project like this, that if things didn't go smoothly, that you'd really have to hawk everything that you never own in the future?
Yeah, it's funny because I think what happened to me is you get a little obsessed, you get a little crazed. It's kind of like, you know, throwing yourself into the river before you know whether you're going to be able to swim. I started the project and I really didn't know what was going to happen with it, but then I got so consumed by it that I couldn't stop to think, you know, what would happen if it never got distributed or never got released. And I think that obsession is what drove me to finish it.
How did you go about raising money? I should think, like, if you're approaching people for money, it would probably be easier to get money for a more mainstream sensibility or high art type of movie than for something about new wave people.
Yeah. Well, originally I had I was able to put together about $25,000, and a lot of that was my own money. I had gotten a royalty check from a film that had an earlier film of mine that had just sold to Scandinavian TV, and I figured if I don't reinvest the money in another film, I was going to blow it. So initially, I thought I could make the entire film for $25,000, and I had scheduled a 5-week shoot. What happened was, by the end of the second week, I had used up $18,000 because I really didn't know how to budget properly. I'd never done a feature before. And then at that point, that's when Susan broke her leg. So we stopped filming for 4 months. And it was during that 4 months that I was able to reevaluate the whole production process. And also at that point, I realized that I was going to need more money and I wasn't going to be able to get it myself. So I joined with a lawyer who put together limited partnership, and I was able to sell points in the limited partnership to friends, family, friends of friends. I mean, really anyone who would buy a point. But also the advantage was that at that point, since I had shot 2 weeks worth of footage, I was able to show people footage. And it certainly helps being able to show people what you want to do rather than just talk about it.
Is it hard to approach friends and their families for backing?
Yeah. It kind of puts you in a funny and awkward position. But as I said, I had started the project already. And so at that point, I was so consumed by it that, you know, you kind of swallow your pride and you just plot ahead.
Smithereens was the first independent film to be entered, American independent film, mm-hmm. to be entered into one of the major competitions at the Cannes Film Festival. Yeah. How did that come about?
At some point, I tell you, I had 4 months when we weren't doing anything because of Susan Berman's broken leg. Somewhere during that period, I decided to send out postcards just requesting application forms to various film festivals around the world, and one of them was the Cannes Film Festival. And I kind of sent this letter off and then forgot about it. And several months later, I got a letter back saying that a Monsieur so-and-so from the festival was going to be in New York and he was going to be screening films for the festival. And I was told to submit my film to this given address. And at that time, I had everything done in the film, but I hadn't processed it in the laboratory yet. So I ran around New York trying to find a laboratory that would get me a print of the film in 2 weeks. I finally found one that would, and I literally picked it up from the laboratory and dropped it off at the screening room the same day. So I had never showed the finished film to anyone. I had no idea what the response was going to be. And I guess the next day the Frenchman saw the film, and I got a phone call that night from him saying he would like to meet me for breakfast the following day. And I took that as a good sign. And we met, and he told me he liked the film very much, but if he was going to put it in the festival, it had to be in 35 millimeter, and the film was shot in 16 millimeter, and it was going to cost me about $25,000 to blow it up to 35 millimeter and to subtitle it in French. And at that point, I was totally broke, and I just couldn't go to any more friends and borrow money. I had used up all my resources. So by the end of breakfast, the conversation had kind of dwindled to, well, nice film, maybe next time. Too bad you can't get the money. But as kind of luck would have it, the Frenchman noticed sitting two tables away from us a German man that he knew who happened to be the head of one of the major art film distributors in Europe. And anyway, he walked over and asked the man if he would mind seeing Smithereens the following day. And the man was eating breakfast with another woman who I didn't know at the time. The next day, the man and the woman came to see Smithereens, and I didn't hear from them for 4 days. And then on the fifth day, I got a phone call from the woman who said she would give me $25,000. And that kind of guaranteed that the film would be accepted into the festival.
What kind of reaction did it get at the festival?
It got a pretty good reaction. In fact, it really surprised me. I think in part the fact that the film was made for $80,000 and that it was, you know, that there were no famous stars in it and that it was kind of an honest, gritty little film. I think people responded to in a real positive way, because I think there was kind of people were getting tired of big pretentious, big-budget films. So I think the idea that it was kind of a quirky little film made for no money appealed to them. And I think also the French liked it because I think the French are very intrigued by American pop culture.
It got you a lot of publicity, too, because people notice what's at the festival.
Yeah.
Susan Seidelman's my guest, and she's the director and producer of the film Smithereens, which will open tomorrow night at the TLA on 3rd and South Streets. And I haven't mentioned that she will be there for the screening in the evening.
Yeah, the 8 o'clock screening.
The 8 o'clock screening, and she'll be there to discuss the film. So now that you have a successful independent film, do you plan on now teaming up with the studio or officially going to Hollywood?
Yeah, I have no real desire to go to Hollywood. I don't think I ever want to live in Los Angeles. I really like New York. But what I'm doing right now is an independent producer has approached me. Actually, it's a guy named Edgar Sherrick who produced the movie Shoot the Moon. And although he works out of Hollywood, he's still an independent producer. And he's approached me with the opportunity to raise money to do a project that I'm interested in, that I'd be writing with another, working with another writer on, and it'll be shot in New York.
So that will mean that you can relinquish the producer job?
Yeah. I mean, in the past I produced just because I was the only producer who would give myself a chance at directing. I really don't want to be a producer, though.
You'd rather just direct?
Yeah.
Do you want to act at all?
No. No. acting is a lot harder than it looks, and I have no skill in that area.
You went to NYU Film School?
Yeah. Yeah.
What was useful and what was irrelevant about film school for you?
For me, the best thing about film school is it gives you an opportunity to make films. And I think that filmmaking is not something that you can learn how to do by reading a book about it or anything. I think you have to touch the equipment. You have to have hands-on experience. And I think the great thing about film school was it did give you an opportunity to play with the equipment and also to make friends with other people who like films. And, for example, most of the people who worked on the crew of Smithereens were people that I had met through film school. So you form a kind of group of people who all have hopefully similar interests.
Has your class gone on to make a lot of successful movies?
A few people. One person from NYU now works as an editor for Woody Allen. Another person edited Peter Bogdanovich's film, They All Laughed. Aside from those two, for the most part, a lot of them get work in New York doing industrials or commercials and stuff like that.
There's music in your film Smithereens. Mm-hmm. What kind of music do you listen to?
Mm-hmm. Well, right now it's interesting because I've been listening to a lot of Brazilian and African music. I think what's getting popular in New York right now is very rhythmic stuff, like samba music, like, King Sunny Ade, Nigerian music, and also funk music's very popular right now.
Are you free to talk about what your next project is going to be that the producer of Shoot the Moon is going to do?
Oh, God. In the crudest possible terms, it's sort of like a female diner, you know, the movie Diner. But really what it's about, I'm really interested in female bonding and female friendship. And what I've been surprised by, in the last couple of years, there have been all these films about male coming-of-age films, whether it's Diner or whether it's American Graffiti or now this film, The Outsiders. You always see, a group of boys together and the relationship between, the buddy-buddy relationship. And I think there really hasn't been a film that dealt with the female coming-of-age experience, maybe because there aren't any female directors making those films. But, I think it's the flip side of the coin that I think it's important that it be shown. And so the film I'm making, it's set in the early 60s, and it revolves around a girl group, a girl musical group, because also in the early 60s was when the girl group sound was very popular, like the Shangri-Las, the Ronettes, that kind of music. And so using the idea of three girls who are in a girl group as the sort of umbrella under which I'll deal with the relationships between these three young women seemed like a really interesting idea for me because it combines my interest in music with my interest in female friendship.
That sounds great. Are they going to do their own music or are you going to use records?
The background music will probably be music from the time period, from 1964. But the music that the girls sing will be original music.
Who's going to write it, do you know?
I don't know. There's a woman that I'm interested in using who, her name's Adele Berté, who's a musician in New York, who is an actress and also is on Geffen Records.
Have you ever played music?
No. But I grew up listening to rock and roll, so it certainly was a large part of my teenage experience.
What are some of the mistakes on Smithereens that you made that you'd never do again on your next movie?
I think for me the biggest thing that I underestimated was how much pre-production you have to do when you're making a movie. I mean, especially when you don't have much money, you have to really do your homework, and you have to be even more prepared than maybe a studio would be because you can't throw around money to make up for your mistakes. And I think I just wasn't aware of how much advanced scheduling and organization you have to do. I think for me, what I found that the job of a director is really, maybe 10 to 20% creative and 80% organizational. And anyone who thinks that you being a director is totally artistic is really mistaken, because filmmaking really is, first of all, it's a collaborative thing. And so the job of the director is to coordinate your vision and communicate that to all the people you're working with. So you have to know how to get other people to see what you're seeing. And it involves a lot of preparation, you know.
How would you go about casting for your next film? The first one, it seems like the typical things like auditions didn't really work, and you found your people
by being just street people.
Yeah.
Yeah, what I'd like to do in this new film is I really would like a combination of professional actors and actresses with some just street people, because I think that there's a level of reality that that street people can bring to a film that I think is really interesting. It's funny because I just saw the new Robert Duvall film, Angelo, My Love, which is about gypsies, and it's using real gypsies that live in New York to play more or less themselves. And I think that the charm and the wonder of that film was really the fact that he could never have found actors to be as authentic as the real people that he used. So, you know, the illusion and the reality, mixing illusion and reality, is an intriguing idea for me.
Are there people who performed in Smithereens getting other acting roles now?
It's funny because Susan Berman has been up for a couple of things. She hasn't gotten them, but she was up for a part in the John Irving movie Hotel New Hampshire, but she lost out to Nastasia Kinski. Not bad. And Brad Rinn has been up for some things at Universal. So they've been getting attention from the major studios, although nothing has happened for them yet, but I'm sure something will in the future.
Must be very tempting for you to go for the big money now.
For me, again, I don't know, I find directing, it's really too hard to do just for money. You know, if I just wanted to make money, I'd probably go into real estate or something. I couldn't see just being a director for hire, you know, which a lot of the directors in L.A. are, you know, they just, projects are turned over to them and they just sort of direct it as a job. And for me, that's why I like to get involved in every stage of it. I mean, in this new film, I'm involved in the writing of this script, and I hope to also be involved in the editing, because for me, again, a film is, in some ways, it's one thing when you write it, and it becomes something else when you film it, and it becomes a third thing when you edit it. And not to be involved in all those steps, I think, it is uninteresting.
What are some of the movies that you wish you'd made?
I wish I made, some of the early Italian Fellini films, like Knights of Cabiria and La Strada, I wish I had made. As far as American films, I wish I had made Mean Streets. I really like Martin Scorsese's work a lot. There's I think it's a Swiss film called La Salamandra, Alan Tanner made, that I think is really wonderful, and I wish I had made that one.
Sometimes people go through a thing of copying the people who they admire a lot, uh-huh. and then developing their own style out of the fact that they can't do a very good job copying the other person's style. Did you ever go through that?
Not copying, but I think Martin Scorsese's films have really influenced me. I mean, there's a kind of urban grittiness to his films that I really like, and I think also his characters, he deals with marginal characters, which I find intriguing. And there's also an authenticity. I mean, I think, I don't know Robert De Niro personally, but I have a feeling that a lot of Robert De Niro goes into the characters that he plays. And using actors that have that kind of energy really appeals to me.
How many times have you seen Smithereens?
Oh, hundreds. I edited Smithereens, so I saw it every day for about 6 months.
Can you watch it anymore, like you'll be at the TLA tomorrow night? Are you going to be in the theater or outside while it's screened?
It's funny, because I usually go in and I usually sit through the first 20 minutes or so just so I can pick up the audience reaction. And then I leave after that, because it's real hard to sit through the whole thing.
Do you watch a lot of movies?
I used to. It's funny because when I'm making a film, it's sometimes hard for me to watch other films when I'm working on my own, because I get too easily influenced. and it becomes a distraction. So when I'm not working in a film, I see a lot, but less so now that I'm working on something.
When I saw your film in New York, there was a coming attraction for a film by the Bees, mm-hmm. On it, who are, I guess you could say, new wave filmmakers. Mm-hmm. Have you seen their work at all?
Yeah, I've seen a few of their films. They used to work in Super 8.
Do you feel any affinity with that, or do you feel what you're doing is completely different?
I think our films are different, but I feel a certain affinity because the process that we go through to make films is similar. I mean, we're both working with very small budgets and using a lot of our actors are from the rock and roll world, using sort of rock and roll performers as actors. And also a lot of the settings are kind of New York by night, marginal, the underground side of New York.
So a lot of rock and roll performers approaching you now and asking to be in your next films?
Some, not a lot. Some. But I think what's interesting that what's happening in the last couple of years is that in New York, there really has been a strong movement in independent cinema coming out of the downtown New York scene. People like, I don't know, Amos Poe or Jim Jarmusch and the Bees. And I think there's also been a growing audience interest in that kind of filmmaking, because I think people are getting a little bored with some of the overproduced Hollywood films.
Now that you've had success with Smithereens, mm-hmm. in addition to getting things from other people like funding and mm-hmm. whatnot, you're probably in the position of having to learn how to say no, because now people are coming to you, you're visible, mm-hmm. and you're successful. Is that hard to do, to turn people
no.
down?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm not sure.
I'm sure performers are coming up to you and asking to be in your movie, and maybe people are offering you ideas for scripts and want you to either produce or direct it.
Right.
And people who want to be your cameraman and work with you and do graffiti for your next set and so on and so on.
Yeah, I think for me, you do get, I have gotten a lot of offers, but I think you can say no politely. And I think also that I have a very strong idea about, I'm not interested in doing somebody else's project. I'm really mostly interested in generating my own projects. And if I explain that to people, they usually understand, you know.
What'd you get your undergraduate degree in?
Oh, boy. I went to Drexel. And I started out as a design major, fashion design major. And it was interesting because the first year was basically a fine arts curriculum, which I enjoyed. But then the second year was a lot of tailoring and sewing courses, and I quickly learned that I did not like to sew. And it was because of that that I started then taking film classes at Drexel. Initially, I just started taking these classes because I thought it would be an easy way and a fun way to get 3 credits. You know, I'll go and I'll sit in a class, I'll watch a movie, and I'll get 3 credits. That doesn't seem too bad. And then somewhere along the line, I think something just clicked in my head, and I started suddenly seeing films in a new way. And I didn't know how I could actually go about making a career out of all this. But what happened was I graduated from Drexel, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And I got a job working at Channel 17 here in Philadelphia. And it was interesting for a little while, but it wasn't, since they do mostly syndicated programming, it wasn't really hands-on experience in anything. And so I thought, well, maybe I should go to film school. And I applied to Temple, and I was rejected from Temple. And as a result of that, I ended up applying to NYU, and I was accepted. And that's where I first started making films.
I bet Temple's sorry about that now. Well, I want to thank you a lot for joining us, and I enjoyed Smithereens, and I'm glad you're able to be here.
Great.
Susan Seidelman has been my guest, and she's from this area, grew up in Abington, now lives in New York. And her movie Smithereens will be showing for a week at the TLA on 3rd and South Street, and that run begins tomorrow night. She'll be there for the 8 o'clock show tomorrow night. It will be the TLA through the 12th, then on May 13th, it moves to the Roxy Theater at 2021 Sansom Street, and it will play at the Roxy from the 13th through the 19th. And again, Susan Seidelman will be at the screening tomorrow at the TLA at 8 o'clock to talk about the film. Well, this is Fresh Air, and let's listen to another recording by Richard Hell, who was one of the featured actors in Smithereens.
Down at the rock and roll. Are you gonna go out tonight? Well, I am uncertain, I ain't feeling too right. But I rip up my shirt, watch the Mary Bird. Yeah, I'm going out, out in the sight. At the door of the club, lounging, I'm so impressed. Then you open the door, and the noise takes the floor. Oh, baby, night after night, here tonight is the best. Yo! Uh-huh! Ricochets round everyone's part, yeah.
Richard Hell and the Voidoids from the Blank Generation album. That was down at the Rock and Roll Club, and Richard Hell is one of the stars of Smithereens, which opens tomorrow night at the TLA on 3rd and South Street. 4 minutes to 5 o'clock is the time, and we'll be joining National Public Radio for All Things Considered at 5. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air in just a minute, but let's check in first with Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. Heading home on the Schuylkill Expressway westbound, traffic slows between South and Vine, a little bit around City Line Avenue. Eastbound, it's running its normal slow volume between 30th and South. No major problems on the Roosevelt Extension. In the detour, you'll find Hunting Park slow between Wissahickon and Broad. I-95 northbound slows for a half a mile approaching the Ray Street merger. If you're traveling southbound 95, about a 15-minute delay off the Girard Point Bridge down to the Platte Detour Road. Vine Street westbound this afternoon running slow between 10th and 16th Streets. Westbound Walt Whitman Bridge, a minor delay at the toll. Eastbound, no problems. And southbound 42, just a minor delay at 295. And the Wissahickon Drive northbound, a little bit slow from Henry through Rittenhouse. On that shadow traffic for WHYY 91 FM, this is John Brown.
And that shadow traffic report was funded with a grant from Wilkie Buick Subaru. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by jazz drummer Rashid Ali. And at 4 o'clock, my guests will be Tony Hendra and Sean Kelly, who are satirists and the authors of Not the New York Times, Not the Wall Street Journal, and a new book called Not the Bible, which is a spoof not only of the Bible, but of a lot of religious programming as well. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can be with us. By the way, this Sunday afternoon on The Best of Fresh Air, we'll be featuring interviews with three humorists, writer Fran Lebowitz, New Yorker cartoonist Ed Koren, and Alfred Gingold, who wrote the items from our catalog spoof of the L.L. Bean catalog. So that's this Sunday at 2 o'clock. I hope you can be listening. Paul Keller was the technical director for today's program. Maeve McGoran is the production assistant. Danny Miller is the co-producer of the program. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley. Stay tuned for All Things Considered.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nina Totenberg.
And I'm David Malpas with All Things Considered.
Stock market is a barometer of well-being. When it goes up, consumers and businesses are both wealthier. People feel better. And if they convert a small percentage of these paper profits into spending, it will be a plus for the recovery.
The stock market has been surging since last August. It's gone from an economic indicator to an economic stimulus. Tonight, the benefits and risks of using the stock market as an engine of economic recovery.
Also, an analysis of the House vote on the nuclear freeze.
The Odd Couple, a joint venture between communist China and capitalist American Motors.
More optimism on an agreement for troop withdrawal from Lebanon.
First, this news.
This is Brian Naylor. In Lebanon, the heaviest fighting since Israel's invasion last summer took place outside Beirut today between Christian and Muslim militias. Five were reported killed and 22 injured in an artillery battle. One of those narrowly escaping injury was the commander of the U.S. Marines in Beirut, whose helicopter was strafed with machine gun fire. Israel's cabinet is on the verge of accepting a proposed agreement for troop withdrawals from Lebanon, according to an unnamed cabinet source. The cabinet is due to meet tomorrow, and U.S. officials are expecting a firm decision on the proposal. The agreement was hammered out by Secretary of State Schultz during 8 days of shuttling between Beirut and Jerusalem in an attempt to end a four-month-long deadlock. The two controversial Indian Point nuclear reactors in New York will be shut down unless the power company that runs them comes up with an emergency evacuation plan for surrounding communities. That was the unanimous verdict today of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. The commissioners imposed a June 9th deadline on Consolidated Edison, but as NPR's Daniel Zwerdling reports, it's not the first deadline the utility has faced.
Depending on whom you talk to, today's vote either shows that the NRC is getting tough with the nuclear industry, or it shows that the NRC is giving in. In the past, efforts to design an emergency evacuation plan for the Indian Point reactor have failed. Local bus drivers, for instance, have said they won't drive their buses if there's a nuclear accident. And government leaders of nearby Rockland County say they don't want to participate in any evacuation plans either. So today, the NRC told Con Edison, you better come up with some emergency evacuation plan or you will have to close the reactor. A spokesperson for the Union of Concerned Scientists says today's action shows how weak the NRC is. Ellen Weiss points out that the NRC has already ordered Consolidated Edison and local officials to come up with an emergency plan or else three times since 1981. And each time the deadline's been broken, the NRC has withdrawn its threat and given them another chance. Today's vote sets the fourth deadline. Only this time, NRC officials say, they really mean it. I'm Daniel Zwerdling in Washington.
The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee will vote tomorrow on the confirmation of William Ruckelshaus to head the Environmental Protection Agency. Today, Ruckelshaus spent his second day testifying before the Senate panel. More from NPR's Wendy Kaufman.
Ruckelshaus told the Senate panel that cleaning up the nation's worst toxic dumps would be a top priority at EPA.
We don't need to answer the question of who pays before we go about cleaning up the dumps. We are going to be aggressive. We are going to get on with these plans and get on with the efforts to get the dumps cleaned up as expeditiously as possible.
During the stewardship of former Administrator Ann Burford, EPA was accused of refusing to clean up toxic dumps so as not to spend money from the so-called Superfund. In addition to a change in policy on cleaning up dump sites, Ruckelshaus said today he would move quickly toward a strategy for dealing with the problem of acid rain. He suggested the administration would not send a Clean Air Act bill to the Congress since it was likely to be rejected. But he reiterated his views that the law needs fundamental changes. He has argued that basing air quality standards solely on public health, as they are now, is irrational. The Senate committee is expected to overwhelmingly approve the Ruckelshaus nomination tomorrow. The full Senate is likely to confirm him early next week. I'm Wendy Kaufman in Washington.
South Africa's ruling National Party today unveiled its long-awaited constitutional reforms that provide limited power sharing for the country's mixed-race citizens and Asians. But as the BBC's Michael Vesti reports, it offers nothing for South Africa's black majority.
Opposition to the new constitution from both left and right has been building up for some time. But now that the bill has been published, the battle is expected to begin in earnest. The present Westminster system of parliament is to be abolished. The Prime Minister will be replaced by an all-powerful executive president. The country's 2.5 million coloureds and roughly 1 million Indians will each have their own parliament alongside a House of Assembly for the 4.5 million whites. South Africa's 20 million blacks will have nothing except self-rule in their independent tribal homelands, which aren't recognised by the rest of the world. The new constitution is opposed by the White Liberal Progressive Federal Party because it excludes blacks. But this party faces the dilemma of not wishing to align itself with the ultra-right Conservative Party led by a former cabinet minister, Dr. Andries Troenekt. His party is against any form of power sharing, however limited, and his supporters believe it will prove to be the thin end of the wedge, with blacks eventually having their own chamber and seats in the cabinet.
The BBC's Michael Vesti reporting from Johannesburg. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up more than 7.5 points. The index of 30 industrials now stands at 1219.72. In heavy trading, 108 million shares changed hands. I'm Brian Naylor, National Public Radio, reporting from Washington.
President Reagan today reacted to House passage of a nuclear freeze resolution last night, though the House approved the freeze by a vote of 278 to 149. The president says, quote, "If the resolution is debated in the Senate, the doubts in opposition to a simple freeze will continue to grow." But freeze sponsors, Democrat Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts and Republican Mark Hatfield of Oregon, disagree.
The nuclear freeze movement is not stopped. It's going on. And whatever the Senate does on this initially, and we're going to push for victory, the nuclear freeze movement is out there well and strong, and that's where it started. It did not start with Senator Kennedy and my introducing the resolution. It was there already in New England, in the Midwest, in the South, in the West. It's not only in the United States, it's in Europe, it's in Asia, behind the Iron Curtain. It's a global people's movement. Now, people's movement's not going to stop on the basis of a Senate vote, one way or the other.
Senator Mark Hatfield. NPR's Cokie Roberts has been following the debate on the resolution, which calls for negotiations for an immediate, mutual, and verifiable freeze on nuclear weapons in the United States and the Soviet Union. Cokie, the resolution in the House seemed anything but simple by the time it passed. What happened?
Well, in the course of the debate, the actual resolution doubled its size, David, went from 750 to 50.